This evening we turn again to continue our present studies in the times and the life of Abraham. In the book of Genesis we are looking at Abraham, not exhaustively but nonetheless sufficiently to grasp something of the significance of this man who, according to the New Testament, is one of the great figures in the overall scheme of salvation. Indeed, to such a degree is Abraham important in God's plan of salvation that the Apostle Paul describes him as the father of us all. And you remember a number of weeks and months ago now we began this present study in chapter 17 in the book of Genesis by reminding ourselves of that occasion when God renewed his covenant promise to Abram and changed his name, Abram, exalted father, to Abraham, Abraham, the father of a multitude. And Sarah's name was also changed on that occasion, symbolic of the new relationship and the new significance that they had in God's purposes of grace for all the world. And we've been looking at some of the incidents in Abram's life. And we came eventually, after a while, to chapter 21, and we looked at the opening verses, the first 11 verses, you remember, a couple of weeks ago, where we saw the birth of Isaac, and we noticed certain things about the birth of Isaac. It was according to God's promise and God's power and his overall scheme of salvation. And we closed off on that occasion looking at the persecution from verse 9 to 11 that began after Isaac was weaned. And I mentioned on that occasion that we were going to go on to the following verses, 9 through to 21 of Genesis 21. But you may remember that on second thoughts, I thought we would backtrack. So we were considering chapter 16 last Sunday evening, looking at the birth of Ishmael, the sad circumstances, the complex family relationships that led to the birth of Ishmael. And I don't think we can truly understand the circumstances that surround the expulsion of Ishmael that we're going to be looking at this evening without understanding something of the background that took place a number of years beforehand when Ishmael came into the world in less than happy circumstances, as we were seeing last Sunday evening. And we're going to refer to one or two of the points again this evening to explain some of the things that are taking place in the passage that we have before us. So we're still dealing basically with the times of Abraham, even although we have looked at the destruction of Sodom and the whole sad episode of Lot and Lot's wife and Lot and his daughters and all these things that took place, in which Abraham played some part, you remember, praying for the righteous in Sodom to be delivered. And as long as the righteous were in Sodom, the city would never be destroyed by the Lord. And there are principles, you know, for that, of that, right down to our own day. God preserves the world because of the sake of his people. He has a people in the world whom he is going to save. And as long as his people are in the world will remain for their salvation. And these are implications that we find scattered in different places in the Bible. Well, anyway, we come then this evening back to chapter 21, and we pick up from the narrative of the birth of Isaac that we were looking at last time, and we're going to overlap. We looked at the first 11 verses a couple of weeks ago, but we're going to pick up again at verse 9, because there is an overlap, and these verses 9 to 11 explain in a great deal of measure, and indeed seriousness, why it is that Hagar and Ishmael, her son, are expelled from the household of Abram and expelled from the covenant, the visible covenant of grace in the world. And these are solemn issues that we've got to look at. What does the Bible mean to tell us? There is no question, as we have seen, that the whole life of Abraham is not uh, as it were, paraded before us, but certain items of some importance are mentioned. And there are periods of Abram's life where nothing much seems to happen. Between the end of chapter 21 and the beginning of chapter 2, as we're going to see, when Abram is tested in that awful way to offer up his son, his son Isaac, there doesn't seem to be much to report concerning the life of Abraham until that occasion when God visits him again and severely tests this good man. So it's not everything in Abram's life that's recorded. We don't have a biography in any meaningful sense of the word. We have isolated, selected incidents that high point the character and the place that Abraham plays in God's purposes of grace. Well, we come then to chapter 21, and let's remind ourselves of what these verses actually say, because we have to, as best as we can, remain true to the actual narrative. What does the Bible actually say about these things? That's important. It's not what the commentators say or what any church says. What does the Bible have to say? And so we pick up at verse 9 in Genesis chapter 21. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abram, cast out this bondwoman with her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abram's sight because of his son Ishmael. And God said unto Abram, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, and because of thy bondwoman. In all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice. For in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And also the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is thy seed. And Abram rose up early in the morning, and took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder. And the child, he gave her the child also, and sent her away, and she departed, and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs. And she went and sat down, her down over against him, a good way off, as it were a bowshot. For she said, let me not see the death of the child, or the young lad. And she sat over against him, and lifted up her voice, and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven, and said unto her, what aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not. For God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, hold him in thy hand, for I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. And there you have what is really straight narrative, simple, uncomplicated history, which just relates the events as they took place. And it is in the interpretation of what is actually taking place here that our main interest has to lie. Because as we were reading in Galatians chapter 4, the Apostle Paul makes quite a big issue out of this particular narrative in the Old Testament. And so what then are we going to say? What is going on here when we find that Hagar and Ishmael are expelled? They're expelled at the instigation of Sarah. They are expelled with the consent, the somewhat reluctant consent of Abraham. And they are expelled at the express commandment of God. And on the face of it, it seems to be something rather cruel, because this is not the first time that Hagar has departed from the household of Abram, as we saw last Sunday evening when, you remember in chapter 16, she was cruelly treated by Sarah. And she was indeed, as it were, she fled because of the rather cruel treatment that she was, in fact receiving from Sarah. And so we have to ask the question, why is it that she is fleeing, as it were, again, or expelled this particular occasion? What is going on here? Well, let's begin where the text begins. And it begins with Sarah. And we're told something rather insightful and something very interesting about Sarah. Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, and she had borne unto Abram mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abram, cast out this bondwoman and her son. Now, Sarah, as we saw last time, is partly responsible for the birth of Ishmael. We saw, you remember last time in the opening verses, how Sarah herself had no child. Time was passing. Her patience was probably wearing rather thin. Her prayers seemed to be going unanswered. Her hope was declining. Because with each passing day, her window of opportunity is declining also. And yet she knew that somehow or other, through a child of Abraham, a promised seed was going to be given who would be a blessing to the world. And she was anxious to have the promise of God fulfilled. And if she could not herself have a child, then at least let her husband Abraham have a child through Hagar, the Egyptian handmaid. And you remember how Sarah gave Hagar. Abraham took no initiative in the relationship that he had with Hagar, not initially. We are told in the scriptures that it was Sarah who took her maid, and she gave her to Abraham as his wife. And through that second wife, Abraham would have a child whom Sarah was hoping would be the child of promise. So here she was interfering with God's timing. And the child is born, and circumstances, as we saw last time, arise, which Abraham and Sarah had never dreamed in their wildest dreams could possibly come to pass. There began a disharmony in the family. Hagar began to despise her mistress, and Sarah was mightily grieved, and it seems she was tormented, not just occasionally, but a continual sense of grievance, because there was a continual despising on the part of Hagar, because she was having the child and her mistress was barren. And that's the unhappy family situation that these three people find themselves in, because they have interfered in God's purpose and God's timing. And so the circumstance that's arising now in Genesis 21, when Hagar and Ishmael finally are put out, is in a sense of Sarah's making. She initiated this whole series of events that lead to this awful circumstance. But Sarah, we mustn't misunderstand Sarah. We mustn't see her as some kind of vindictive, cruel individual who, now that she has her own child, Isaac, is now practicing one-upmanship on the slave girl, Hagar. That's not the circumstance. We know that Abraham was 75 years of age when he came out of Egypt, when he came out into the land of Canaan, out of the Chaldees. We know that he was 86 when Ishmael was born. We know that he was 100 when Isaac was born. That means that Ishmael was 14 years of age when Isaac was born. The events that we're reading about take place after Isaac is weaned. And that would be probably when Isaac was 2 or more years of age. Now, we do not know how long after Isaac was born, how long after that the events recorded in these verses took place. It may have been a number of years. But Ishmael, at any rate, is at least a boy of 16 or 17 years. He may well be older. There are some who believe that he may have been up to the age of 20, because time is passing. But however old Ishmael is, something in the character of Ishmael is beginning to emerge. And Sarah is beginning to see it. And it seems that Abraham is blind to the true nature of this child, this young man, this lad, Ishmael. It seems that Abraham is not recognizing something that is before his very eyes. And that is that Ishmael is beginning to mock, and beginning, in the words of the Apostle Paul, actually to persecute his son Isaac, who is the child of promise. But Sarah, who no doubt has a mother's eye a jealous paternal protective eye towards her son Isaac. No doubt she is seeing things and sensing things that her husband Abraham is not seeing. And so when we are told here that Sarah saw the son of Hagar, that she saw him mocking, this is not some little occasional flippant boyhood pranking about. It's not that these two boys are tumbling around and making fun of each other. That's not what the word means. The word here for mocking is a word that means he was continually mocking. And it means that he was laughing in derision. So it means that Ishmael is, as he is growing up, he is beginning to look at Isaac. And all he can see in Isaac is an object of mockery and contempt. He recognizes, of course, that Isaac is a child of promise where he is not. But that's about all that he recognizes. He doesn't see the significance. He doesn't appreciate the arrival into this world of Isaac. He doesn't recognize the great thing that God has done in giving Abraham and Sarah a child of their own, the precious child of promise. And Ishmael has no appreciation of that whatsoever. All he sees is someone that he can persecute and bully because he is the bigger of the two. And as Sarah is observing the behavior of this child of Hagar, she is recognizing not just some young manly boisterousness, she is recognizing something of a sinister and a dangerous nature. She is, when she says, this son of the bondwoman will not inherit, she's not speaking simply of some earthly temporal inheritance. She is speaking in terms of spiritual inheritance. And what she is in fact saying is, my son Isaac and Ishmael, they belong to two different religions. They belong to two different worldviews completely. They belong to two different destinies. And she knew that her child, Isaac, was a child of promise who was going to the glory. And it is evident by the time that Ishmael is 16 or 17 or whatever, he is beginning to express himself. He's beginning to show and to give his opinions. Now you and I might say, well, is this not harmless? After all, he's only a boy. Only a boy. Let me tell you that boys of 16 and 17, when they begin to flex their muscles, and when they begin to give their opinions as to what the world is right and what the world should be and is not, when they begin to speak up, they begin to reveal themselves. And you find very often in congregations, it's boys and girls too of 16, 17 and 18 who begin to criticize the things of God and who begin to look down and to mock at those who regularly attend church meetings and who pray and whose life is a life of piety. And who believe that the God of mercy is the God of grace alone. And all that is foolishness in the eyes of these young 16, 17, and 18-year-olds. They begin to show their antagonism. They may well remain within the circle of God's redeemed people on the earth for a time. But they no longer belong to it. There is something of the world beginning to enter in and to captivate them. And when they look at God's people, they look at God's people with a mocking contempt. We have to be clear, this is what's happening in the household. Ishmael is now of an age where he's beginning to express himself, live his own life. And basically what he is saying is this life that Isaac has entered into and that Abraham and Sarah have entered into, this life is not for me. This is something that he finds ridiculous, and it is the object of his contempt, and it is persecution. And if we don't grasp this biblical narrative in that way, we're not going to understand the significance of what Paul is saying, and we're going to come back to it at the end of the sermon. When Paul says, as it was then, there were two, Abram had two children. He actually had more than two children. But these two, Ishmael and Isaac, are significant. Because one represents one kind of religion that has to do with God's grace and God's promise. and the other represents a religion which has got nothing to do except with the flesh. And there are two kinds of religion in this world. There are two kinds of people in this world. There are those who are born of God and there are those who are born of the flesh. We're all born of the flesh. But those who are born of God are born out of the flesh again. And those who are born of the flesh and live in the flesh, they simply remain flesh. That's all they ever are. That which is born of the flesh is flesh. And Ishmael is a child of the flesh, pure and simple. Because the relationship that Abraham had with Sarah ought never to have taken place. And in a certain sense, Ishmael should never really have been born in that sense. He was born. But he wasn't born according to God's promise and to God's purpose. He was born according to Abraham and Sarah and Hagar's flesh alone. And here he is beginning to show his true colors. And he is mocking. And that means that he is not simply mocking Isaac as an individual. He is mocking Isaac as a representative of God's promises of grace, of salvation for the world. He is mocking the things of God when he mocks Isaac. And that's the seriousness and that's the sinisterness of this. And that is what Sarah is recognizing. She's not overprotective in case her precious little darling Isaac gets his knees scraped or a bump in his elbow or something. That would be understandable enough, but that's not the issue. The issue is the question of inheritance, of where do you really belong and what really belongs to you. That's the issue here. And as one of the commentators puts it rather well, I think, he says, Ishmael is demonstrating that he is a foreign ingredient in this household. He doesn't belong here. He never did belong in the community of God's promised people. He was something that came in because of a bad time in Abraham's life when he went down into Egypt. Abraham would have been better never going anywhere near Egypt. You remember we were looking at it last Sunday. Where did he? How come that an Egyptian slave is found in Abraham's house? How? Because he picked her up in Egypt. And that was the time that he lied concerning Sarah. Abraham wasn't in the prime of spiritual strength and vigor when he went down into Egypt. What was he doing in Egypt in the first place? There was a famine in the land. He could have stayed in Canaan. That was a bad time for Abraham, and it leads to this kind of bad results. One bad decision always leads to other bad decisions in life. But here is Sarah. She is perceiving. When it says here that Sarah saw, it doesn't mean she just looked. It means she discerned. She was looking at something and recognizing what is going on here under the surface. And we have to learn to look at people like that. We are so contented with outward appearances that sometimes we don't see obvious wickedness when it's even before our very eyes, because it comes in the form of some kind of piety at times. But the Bible asks God's people to discern and to judge the spirits. And that's exactly what Sarah is doing. She is not being cruel, unnecessarily cruel, or as it were, having her own back at Hagar because now she is her own child. And he is in preference to Ishmael. That's not the case at all. Sarah is a good and a godly woman, but she's weak too. She has her moments of weakness. And therefore she says, Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, which he had borne unto Abraham, mocking and continually mocking. You could forgive and understand youthful pranks if it was only occasional, but this is a continual activity which begins to reach dangerous levels. And what Sarah is recognizing is that Ishmael actually is becoming a danger to Isaac. He doesn't belong along with Isaac. And that is why she said unto Abram, cast out this bondwoman and her son for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. Because whatever we may say about Ishmael, he was Abraham's son, and furthermore, he was his legitimate son, as we're going to say in a moment. He is a properly born child. He's not illegitimate. He was born legitimately, because Hagar became his wife, we're told in Genesis chapter 16. She was given into him as a wife, a second wife, but nonetheless a real wife. And any children born of that marriage would be legitimately born children. So here is one who is Abraham's true son after the flesh. And it's only natural that the idea of casting him out should grieve the paternal instincts of Abraham. No wonder the thing is very grievous in his sight because of his son. You remember in chapter 17 when God made the covenant, the renewed covenant with Abraham. You remember the prayer that Abraham made on that occasion? Let Ishmael live before you. And he had to be told on that occasion in chapter 17 in Genesis. He was told that Ishmael would live, but in Isaac shall your seed be called. Isaac hadn't even been born then. So the child was to be called Isaac. And the seed of God's promised line of mercy would come through Isaac and not through Ishmael. No wonder poor Abraham is in the quandary and the turmoil that he finds himself in now. And so that's the background. That's the general background. So that's the first thing, just looking at Sarah and how she saw it and what she said concerning it. But there's another issue from verse number 11, 12 onwards, and that is this expulsion or this separation that takes place. Cast out the bondwoman. And that is not simply a vindictive, motherly, overprotective concern. There's a spiritual impetus here, and it's an impetus, as we shall see in a moment, that is approved by God. Now, here we have an example in the Bible of a separation between the godly and the ungodly, and that raises an interesting question and an interesting issue. Because this is not something that Sarah, it seems, has said immediately that she begins to notice the kind of man that Ishmael is growing up into. It seems that time is passing. And this, in a certain sense, is a kind of last resort as far as Sarah is concerned. She probably has put up with this for some time, hoping that maybe Ishmael will change and reveal himself to be a true son of Abraham. But he doesn't do that. The mocking continues until there is nothing more to be done than separation. Now let's understand what this separation is. And I want to press this home. Not only because Sarah wishes it, and eventually Abraham, despite his grieving over the matter, still acquiesces in it, but because God also says that this is his mind in the matter. At verse 12. God said unto Abram, let it not be grievous in thy sight, because of the lad and because of the bondwoman. In all that Sarah has said unto thee, hearken unto her voice. For in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Now here is a place where God is saying to a husband who is reluctant to do something, he's saying to that husband, you listen to your wife in this matter, because she obviously is more discerning than you are, and she happens to be right. On this occasion, she was right. You remember on the previous occasion when Hagar fled in chapter 16, it was not God's will on that occasion that Hagar should leave. You remember the angel of the Lord found her down by the well, and he said, what ails you, Hagar? And he told her to go back, you remember. Go back to Sarah, submit yourself to your mistress, be submissive to her. And Hagar went back. And years passed, and she was growing up, and her child was growing up now in the household of Abraham. But now all these years later, 16, 17 years later, the Lord is saying, agreeing with Sarah, do what Sarah says, cast him out. Now what is taking place here? Let's be clear as to what's taking place. This is a divorce. The Bible knows nothing of married people remaining married and living separately. There's not one iota of teaching in the Bible where that is put up as an option. And the reason I'm mentioning that is because I know of a famous international evangelical preacher who is well known in Reformed circles, and he goes around the world preaching on marriage and divorce and these kinds of things, and he says that separation's allowable, divorce is not allowable except under the extreme conditions of adultery alone. That man is wrong. Where do we find the first divorce mentioned in the Bible? This is it. And it has the approval of God. Where do you think the later prophets, Nehemiah and Ezra, when they commanded the Israelite men to put away the foreign wives when they came back from the exile, where do you think they would get such doctrine from? They had a precedent, Abraham. Where do you think it would be that Malachi, the last book of the Bible, should tell the men of Israel who were marrying these heathen women to put away their wives and their children with them? Where do you think the precedent comes from? It comes from here. You see, Hagar is Abraham's wife. She is not simply a concubine. She is not a slave who has no legal rights. Abraham is actually divorcing Hagar, and he is doing so with God's approval. And the reason he is doing so with God's approval is because, although it is a radical decision to come to, it's not the worst decision, it's the best decision under the circumstances. There is inherent incompatibility between what Hagar stands for and what Abraham and Sarah stand for, as there was between the men of Israel later on and the heathen women. Why do I say that? Why is it that God can say to Abraham, put away the woman, Sarah is right? Why? Because the marriage of Hagar and Abraham ought never to have taken place in the first place. They ought never to have been married. Simple as that. You see, we have this, evangelicals, they go around saying, those that God has joined together, let no man put asunder. I agree with that entirely. Of course we agree with that. Everybody agrees with that. But what about those that God has not joined together? What about those forbidden marriages, where it is nothing more than interfering with God's purpose or the flesh coming to the fore? What about these marriages? They ought never to have taken place, you see. And there are times in life when marriages that should never have been contracted, the best resolve and the best result is to dissolve them. That's God's divorce is God's remedy. Sending away is God's remedy for a situation that has become intolerable and dangerous for Isaac, the child of promise. And there comes a time in life when people, quite frankly, must learn to separate and go their ways because they just can't get on together because they stand basically for different things. You cannot. Can two walk together unless they be agreed? What is marriage? Marriage is a covenant of companionship where God has called us to peace. Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And if we can't live at peace, then break it off and stop pretending. And that is the radical, it's a sad issue. This is not an ideal situation, this is a terrible situation. But nonetheless, it is a God-given remedy. Because there are more important things to take into account than simply the marriage of Hagar and Ishmael. And Christian people, we really should have an understanding of the big picture. I remember a man standing at that door in that church one Sunday morning years and years ago now, and almost putting his finger up my nose and saying, there is only one ground for divorce, and that's adultery. And the man was so convinced, so blind that he couldn't even see how blind he was. God is saying, Hagar to Abraham, put Hagar away. Sarah's right. You got yourself into this mess, now get out of it, and the way to get out of it now is to have this radical breach, do it now, the sooner the better. What must be done, 'tis best done quickly. Very often that's the way it is. And that's what's taking place here. And so there is this separation. And it applies across the board in life, you know. There are times in life when even if we can't get on with our fellow Christian believers, then separate. If we can't live at peace with them, then don't live in disharmony with them. There is a biblical doctrine of separation that doesn't only apply to marriage relationships. It applies in congregational life. It applies in business venture. If you can't get on well in business, if you're a Christian and you find yourself involved with people who don't share your, then terminate it. But we cannot live continually in disharmony because God has called us to peace. And this is the issue as to why there is this expulsion of Hagar and her son Ishmael. In Isaac shall thy seed be called, and Isaac must never be jeopardized in any way by the likes of Hagar or Ishmael. Where do you think Ishmael, this son of the bondwoman, where do you think he would have learned the trick of mocking at Isaac? Sons learn a lot from their mothers. Some have said that the apron strings are the tightest bonds in the whole of the universe. That could well be right. And often you find that when young men begin to express themselves, it's the mother speaking. And I am of the mind with those commentators who say, this man has been brought up very differently. He has been brought up by his mother, Hagar, rather than by his father, Abram. And that is probably why Abram is not recognizing the terrible reality of this son of his. Because he's been too much in his mother's company and not enough in his father's company. And that is a very possible explanation of the tragedy that's unfolding here. Men are to be brought up by their fathers rather than their mothers, if I can put it like that. And when you begin to violate these fundamental laws, you can look out for trouble and sparks flying. And that's what's happening here. For in Isaac shall thy seed be called, and also the son of the bondwoman I will make a nation. God had cared for Hagar the first time she fled, you remember, from Sarah in chapter 16. God cares for her now. He is speaking concerning Ishmael. He's speaking to Abraham. I will make a nation because he is your seed. And then there is this rather interesting detail about Hagar and the beginning of our journey. And it's often misunderstood and given rise, in fact, to a complete misunderstanding of the time factor in all of this. You say, well, what are you talking about? Verse 14. Abraham rose up early in the morning, took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder and the child, and sent her away. Now, the way our version here leads, you'd think that Hagar, here she's got a bottle of water, and she's got some bread, and she puts it on her shoulder, and then she puts the child on the other shoulder, 17-year-old boy. That's not what the text actually says. It says that Hagar was given food and drink, and she also took the lad. Throughout this narrative, the lad is spoken of as though he were a young lad. I grant you that. The Lord heard the lad's call. She took him by the hand and then led him up. But the idea that he is a little baby lad is not to be counted. The sequence of times do not permit that understanding. One of the commentators puts it rather well. He says that he may well have been a young fellow, not fully grown. Hagar, by this time, is a woman in the full maturity of her womanhood. She's a grown-up woman by this time. She's got a boy of 16 years of age, so she's probably over 30 at least. And she's in the prime of life, you might say, and she's probably a strong woman. And the lad hasn't fully grown, so in a sense he's still dependent upon his mother, not for his milk, but for help in times of need. And 16-year-old boys, they need to be looked after by their mothers, we know that. And that's all that's being said here. But the idea, the incongruous idea that Hagar is carrying this 17-year-old boy on her shoulder, please do not entertain that thought. That's not what's being said, actually. the lad cries. She can't bear to see the lad hungry and thirsty, puts him under the bush. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said, "What ails thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Lift up the lad, take him by the hand and lift him up." You and I can lift up an adult by the hand without putting him on our shoulder. "Lift up the lad, hold him in thy hand, for I will make him a great nation." And then we're told of God's provision for her, and so on. And all this is incidental to the text. And then at verse 20 and 21, we have the culmination of the narrative. God was with the lad. That means watching over him, caring for him, providing, protecting him. Remember the prophecy concerning Ishmael. He's going to be a wild man. Every man's hand is going to be against him. And certainly if Ishmael begins to behave himself like this when he goes out into the world, he's going to make enemies all right. Nothing surer than that. And the Lord's looking after him and giving him the promise of being a great nation, the Ishmaelites, from whom the Arabic tribes today claim descendancy, and so on and so on. What is most significant about the final details concerning Hagar and Ishmael in this narrative is they dwelt in the wilderness, and he became an archer. So he is a man who loves the wild places. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. It's not clear where Paran is. The scholars differ, but it seems to be somewhere in the Sinai Peninsula, down towards Egypt. And you remember in chapter 16, we saw last Sunday evening that when Hagar fled from her mistress, she ended up in Shur, and that's on the way, as you go down to Egypt. She was going home. She was going home. And so when she is put out of Abram's household on this occasion by the Lord, she goes, and she goes back to the old places of her familiarity. And we're told this significant thing at verse 21. "And his mother, Hagar, she chose a wife for him out of the land of Egypt." These are your women. These are the wives for you. Later on, when Abraham would choose a wife for his son Isaac, in chapter 24, you remember, it wasn't just go and take the most beautiful, comely one that you can find. It was to go on a long journey, he said to his servant, you remember, and take a wife for Isaac. He went looking for Rebekah, who was a kinswoman, because that woman still belonged to the familial relationship with Abraham. He never would take a woman for his son to marry out of the heathen tribes, Egypt. It's the very thing that Hagar did. Why? Why would she do that? Because the religion of Hagar was the religion of Egypt. She never was one who shared the religion of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah. She was never one who was committed to the God of Abraham. In the Old Testament, you remember, you could be an Israelite. You could belong to the people of Abraham by joining the people of Abraham. In chapter 17, you remember, when God instituted the covenant of circumcision, it wasn't only Abraham's offspring, but his servants, everybody who was born in his house, the whole familial, the whole entourage of Abraham was circumcised on that occasion. Everybody who belonged to Abraham was circumcised. And the implication is that they were happy to remain in this visible community that belonged to Abraham and his God. Hagar and Ishmael had no delight in such things. They belonged outside. And Sarah recognized it before Abram did. And God recognized it. And that is why he said, "Abraham, listen to Sarah and do what she says." Because ultimately it is God who puts Hagar and Ishmael out of the community of the redeemed. And anybody could come and join God's people, but they must live as God's people. It wasn't simply the Hebrews who were redeemed in the Old Testament. There are many Gentiles who came and became Israelites, but they all believed and trusted and loved, and they would never dream of mocking the promises of God, as Ishmael was doing. How much did Hagar know of Isaac? She knew, of course, that he was the child of Sarah's old age. And she may well have said, "Oh, well, my. Well, these things can happen, you know. Good for you, Sarah. In your old age, you managed it at last." Did Hagar understand that the birth of Isaac was not simply a matter of the flesh, but a miracle of God? By faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed. The birth of Isaac is not just a natural event, it's a miraculous event, as we saw a couple of weeks ago. And that doesn't seem to have been understood, or much appreciated at least, by Hagar or by Ishmael. They don't belong, you see. Now, what can we say in the light of all of this? There are a couple of things I want to emphasize. First of all, the situations that we get ourselves into. All of this need never have happened, in a sense. It did happen, and we might say, well, it happened. I'm not one of those who likes very much these what-if books. What if, you know, he'd done something? That's all very well. It's good to speculate. But the point is, what happens has happened. But in a sense, it should never have happened. If Abraham and Sarah had waited upon the Lord, they would have renewed their strength. They would have mounted up with wings like eagles, and they would have walked and not be weary, and running and not be fainting. They brought a lot of trouble upon themselves. And the fact of the matter is that when you and I step out of God's timing or out of God's will, we can guarantee trouble will come. I was watching a documentary just the other day in which Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa was speaking. And he was a man, as you know, who went through hard times for Christianity in that betroubled land of South Africa. And he was speaking and he was saying that there are times in life when all you have is faith. And that's all you have. Circumstances may be big, imprisoned walls may be surrounding you, and you may be suffering a great deal, and you may be full of trouble, but all you have is faith, and you must cling on like grim death, he said. That was the very thing that Abraham and Sarah did not do when they were waiting for a child. They did not cling on like grim death. They thought that they would do something to speed it up, and they brought heartache to themselves and heartache to their descendants, because to this very day, the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Isaac are still at each other's throats to this very day. A lot of trouble in the world because of Abraham, Sarah, and Hagar, and Ishmael. And yet God takes them out of it. He keeps them in it. He keeps his people. And as we're going to see when we come to chapter 22, recording the great temptation, the best of Abraham's life is yet to be. The greatest pinnacle point that he ever reaches is when he is commanded by God to offer Isaac upon the altar, his only son. And Abraham rose up early in the morning to do what God told him to do. The best of Abraham has yet to come out. We'll see that in a week or two, and for a few weeks as well. But then the final issue is not only the situations that we get ourselves into, but the issue that Paul takes up from this very narrative in Galatians chapter 4 that we were reading together, from verse 21 onwards, Paul says, "Now there are two allegories. Abram had two sons, one by the free woman, one by the bond woman. They were both his wives, but one was freeborn and one was slave." One was a slave. And Abram says, "As he who was born after the flesh, then persecuted," Paul reads into this mocking on the behalf of Ishmael, he reads into it persecution. That's the word that he uses in Galatians chapter 4. He persecuted him. So that's why we've been so insistent that this is not some little trivial playing around. The New Testament interpretation of the Old is the final word on the matter. And Paul the Apostle says this was persecution. And he says it's always the same. Those who are born of the flesh always will persecute those who are born of the Spirit. And the spiritual allegory that the Apostle Paul makes of this incident is that there are those who are purely natural, there are those who are spiritual, because the flesh lusts against the Spirit, not only in your life and in mine. You and I know very well within our own lives the pull of the flesh and the pull of the Spirit. And it's true enough within our own bosom. But what about our relationships with the world? It's true there also. The flesh lusts against the Spirit. You try to live as a Christian. As long as you and I just hold our peace and smile at everybody, we'll get on fine. The world will love us. But you and I stand up as children of promise and face a world that is anti-God and anti-Christ. And then we'll soon find that the world won't be smiling, it'll be scowling. Because as he who then persecuted him that was born according to the promise, Paul says it's always been like that. It's always going to be like that. Paul is speaking in Galatians in the context of the law versus the gospel. Are we going to be saved by keeping the law according to the flesh, or are we going to be saved by the gospel? Is it going to be law or grace? Is it going to be natural religion that's going to be our hope? As it was for Hagar and it seems for Ishmael. Are we going to trust in the arm of our flesh? Or is it going to be trusting in the promises of God alone? He who believes in me has everlasting life. Do we believe that? The world doesn't believe it, I tell you. It's always the same. Paul is saying there are these two women. They're like two covenants. They stand for different things. And that's what gives the momentous nature of this narrative and the spiritual undercurrents and undertones whereby even God says, put them away. And so the question as we close this evening, for you and for me, the question is, to which of these women do we belong? Because we belong to one or the other in principle, in allegory. According to Paul in Galatians 4. This is an allegory, he says. It's history, but it's also an allegory. There's a spiritualizing of this, which is perfectly legitimate and biblical. And the issue for you and for me, as it was for these Galatians to whom Paul was writing, to whom do we belong tonight? Are we children of the free woman, born again, according to pure grace alone? Or are we children of Hagar, in bondage to the law and to the flesh, and destined ultimately to be cast out by God himself? That's the issue, you see. And that's where the gospel note must never be lost in preaching from the scriptures. Because there are all these lessons, and they're urgent lessons, because we either belong in God's home in Adam, in Abraham. Do you remember how the poor man died, was carried by the angels to Abraham's bosom? Where do God's people go when they die? They go to Abraham's bosom. And where do those who are not God's people go? They go to that other place where they're cast out into outer darkness. That's what's being enacted here. Cast out this bondwoman and her son. And the issue for you and for me is, are we in the security of the children of the promise of grace? Or do we live according to the flesh and mock the things of God and find ourselves ultimately outside from the people of God? That's a very solemn issue, because there's no neutrality in it. There's no third option. There's no place where we can say, well, this doesn't belong to me. This is you and me in this narrative. And we're either one or we're the other. And that's the way that we're to read the scriptures always. Because all of the scripture is given to make us wise unto salvation through faith in Christ Jesus. May God bless his word.